guess how the pandemic is affecting school detachment. Yep, remote learning made it worse, and many kids are still having trouble readjusting to classrooms. So what is the best approach from the family level right up through the education system to help kids stay connected with schooling? If this is happening to your child or grandchild or your students or a child in your life, I would love to hear from you. How are you handling school refusal? How are the systems stepping in or not stepping in to support you in that? Head to our Facebook page, ABCRN is the page to look for, and check out the Life Matters post on this. Some very heartfelt comments there of people who've been through the ringer with this. Professor Jim Waterston is Dean of the Melbourne Graduate School of Education at the University of Melbourne. Jim, welcome to you.
Yes, good morning.
And Christine Grove is an educational and developmental psychologist and adjunct senior lecturer at Monash University School of Educational Psychology and Counselling. Christine, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
We'll hear a little later in the program from a principal who's working on this as well. But Jim, just to start with, what is the scope of the problem of school refusal? Do we know?
So school refusal comes in many forms. So there's disengagement, which is a student who's not focused on learning. And then it's on a continuum where then students begin to refuse to come to school because of a whole host of reasons, bullying, domestic violence, anxiety. A whole range of other factors and personal attributes such as boredom, identity, whatever. And so that's a major problem in itself. But a report I wrote in 2019 says that right at the end of the continuum is students who completely detach from school. And these are compulsory school age students who no longer are enrolled and no longer participate in education in Australia. And when you tell this story, it's pretty hard for people to believe this. But we estimate conservatively through some fairly committed research that there are at least 50,000 young people in Australia, from a very early age right up to compulsory age of 17, who aren't even enrolled in education in school, and they're losing the capacity to have life chances and be successful because of the education system not recognising that they've left and haven't moved to another site. So
that is hard to get your head around, though, isn't it, Jim? Like, how does that work, that a kid can just wander out of the school system and not be tracked, not be noticed?
Well, there's lots of ways that can happen. One of the ways, which is colloquially referred to as the backdoor exit from schools, is when a student isn't performing well and can be disruptive and maybe causing some trouble, then quite often principal and students have told us this, that quite often principals will take them aside and say, look, there's a better school down the road, or there's somewhere else you should go, and they kind of slip them out without making a big fuss, and that's not understandable, but you can imagine that school communities can be disrupted by students who aren't sort of engaging well. So that's one way. The other way is that students can leave early and go to TAFE and do a secondary schooling course or become an apprentice, and then that doesn't work out. And, two or three weeks after they've moved, they find that it's not suiting their needs and they don't go anywhere else. And one particular student that I met in Queensland 3 years ago told me that he left his home at 10 years of age in New South Wales, and for 5 years, nobody ever discovered that he was roaming free by himself, became an ice addict at 10, and ended up in a school in Queensland at 15 after 5 years, and wanted to come back into education. And so that's an extreme case, but there are lots of different ways that students detach or become completely disengaged. And your point about the pandemic is that we consider now that some of those numbers would be much higher because there has been some difficult.
Well, we're having some difficulties with your line too, Jim Waterston. Professor Jim Waterston.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. Dean of the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. So the pandemic has made things worse. Do we know how much worse?
Well, we've done some research through the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. And so we consider that the studies that we've done indicate that at least 20% of students who were online learners during the pandemic weren't able to connect or didn't have the capability to connect. And so we think that across the board, it's about 20%. And then there's this very small percentage of students who loved online learning because of the bullying and challenges that they faced in face-to-face school. And so there's a small number that we know of that are really worried about coming back and you know, going back into that school environment which didn't suit them previously.
We're talking about school refusal, which can lead to school disengagement and ultimately, as you heard Jim say, school detachment down the extreme end of the spectrum. Christine Grove is a guest with us today too, educational and developmental psychologist. Christine, how are kids feeling generally about being back at school this year, back to normal, supposedly, after a tumultuous couple of years?
Yeah, absolutely. And just echoing Jim, that we have a couple of groups of students that we're seeing. Some are loving being back. You know, they're seeing their friends, they're seeing their teachers, they love the school community. And then we've got a group of students who are like a little bit nervous, not sure, you know, what's this back, you know, being back at school like. And then we have a group who are really struggling that Jim, you know, is speaking to as well, just around being back in the classroom, back with their peers, and are struggling with things like bullying, peer-to-peer relationships, relationships with their teachers, that does end up looking like red flags that they could be leading to potentially detaching from their school community completely. And that's a really big worry, because often I think if we think out of sight, out of mind, that's definitely true for a very busy classroom. If the student's not there, they're not on the mind, you know, they're not on the teacher's mind. So it's easy for them to fall through the system, particularly when they get to that end stage. And I think why this issue is more critical now is that we're seeing more students disengaging completely from their education, and that's where it becomes a really big worry, and we need to be doing more to address some of those challenges.
And perhaps this is something that's been on your mind and your family's minds in the past few years. Head to our Facebook page, ABCRN, and pop a comment on the Life Matters post there on this. You can join some other people telling their stories, which were pretty heart-wrenching, or you can send a text 0418 226 576. What kind of supports are available to you if you're going through this problem of school refusal with your child? How are you handling it? 0418 226 576. Christine, we heard from Jim the huge list of things that can contribute to kids not feeling up to going to school, but I understand that people with autism and ADHD are really high up that list. What's going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know just from, you know, archaic research that routines and systems work really well for students who do have ADHD or developmental challenges and autism. And so making sure that we do have those routines is critical for their education too. And so the pandemic threw that up in the air, as we all know. We all went through that together. And so coming back to school, we need to establish new routines. What can we do for each family, for each student who are experiencing challenges coming back into that context? We need to make sure that we are addressing those challenges directly. And so that looks like things like individualized learning plans, working directly with teachers and the school system to make sure that the student isn't blamed. I appreciate your entry into this topic, talking about stigma. There is so much stigma on this topic. Students often get blamed as the issue. Well, they just didn't connect, or they don't get the content, or, you know, they're the child in the situation. So we need to be working together to address some of these challenges.
Yeah, I imagine
I
just wanted to tackle that issue of stigmatization, because I imagine there's a lot of pressure on parents to just push through and force the child to go to school. Oh. How useful is that approach?
Look, it really comes down to individual. I know you're going to be like, oh, of course, it's always individual, but it absolutely is. So I've had some students who've done really, really well homeschooling, with some being at school. But then, you know, counter to that too, we know from research that's coming out now, post-pandemic world, not post-pandemic, but in a world now where we're at least face-to-face most of the time, and we have predictability in being face-to-face, that students who don't attend school do have struggles with their mental health long term. So even though some of those interactions are challenging, working through that is critical. So if you're in a workplace or if you're in a situation that's, you know, a little bit different to school, working through challenges socially is really important to do that together in a supportive way. And so I actually see this as an opportunity that we can support some of our most vulnerable students in the community to engage in ways that feel comfortable, and that we can make a plan together as a school community to make sure that they are getting that engagement with their school if they need.
And Christine, what are some early signs to look out for to see whether a child might be starting to become disengaged from school?
So it's different for parents and teachers. So if you're a parent, you'll be hearing a lot more of probably the emotional side, like, I don't want to go to school, or I hate school, or even something really subtle, like really dragging out that morning routine, taking a long time to get socks on, or forgetting where their socks are when they usually are really great at getting their socks on or getting used to getting to school on time. So if there's a shift in that that's longer than a week, that's definitely a flag for a parent to then talk to their teacher. How are they going at school? Are there concerns? Is anything flagged with you at school because they're saying they don't like it? So if a parent has any feeling or inkling that their child isn't enjoying their schooling experience, check in with the school, check in with the teacher, because likely the teacher might be seeing a few signs too. And if it teaches, some flags for teachers, they might notice things like their students not raising their hand or engaging at all in any kind of group discussions or paired discussions. Maybe they are different to how they were 2 weeks ago. That's really noticeable. So really critically is to know your students. And I'm sure our principal who's joining us in this conversation can add to that too. Just making sure you know your students. So if they do change, they're not engaged or they're overly engaged, something unusual to their character that you wouldn't ordinarily see is definitely a red flag to either talk to the principal about or the parent too.
Yep, though this whole conversation is making me think of a story we did recently on teacher burnout, which made me wonder how any teacher has the capacity to individually get to know all their students. We'll touch on that again in a moment. But Professor Jim Waddeston, at what point is it best to intervene? How early do these problems start to present?
Oh, absolutely. The intervention needs to start at the very earliest point of the education system. And in Victoria now, where we've just started three-year-old kindergarten, which is available to all families across the state, then the potential now to be able to identify and work with young people who might be exhibiting, sort of signs of reluctance or some of those signs that Christine just talked about at the earliest possible stage. And it's well known in research that the earlier the intervention comes, the more likely that chances in life going through will be better for people right the way through the spectrum. So yes, we need to engage in this right from the very beginning, because people need to understand some of the elements that Christine talked about, and then be watchful for that and work on an individual basis. And you mentioned before it's difficult to personalise learning, but that is part of the problem. You know, we have a very traditional school system around the Western world, but particularly in Australia, and it doesn't suit all people. As we talked about before, there could be disability, and certainly there's a lot more well-being in terms of issues after the pandemic, but that just amplifies what was already in place beforehand. And so being able to identify those young people and look for flexible ways that they can learn, and one of the issues that has come up during the pandemic is the lack of agency that students had in their learning in terms of the online approach, where they were used to a teacher sort of directly teaching them, and then once they had to do their work at home with their parents or whatever, for a lot of young people they couldn't cope, and that's also been a problem, as I said before, that's amplified from prior to COVID. So we do need to be making sure that we cater to the passions and the agency and the reluctance of young people not want to seek attention by asking or talking about what they can't do. So this personalisation, I think, is a real issue, and something that doesn't have to be a separate program for every young person. Mm. But every young person is different, and the teaching practices and processes need to be focused around what will engage those people and make sure they don't fall through the cracks, as we've spoken about.
Mm. We're speaking with Professor Jim Waddeston, Dean at the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, and Christine Grove, Educational and Developmental Psychologist and Adjunct Senior Lecturer at Monash University School of Educational Psychology and Counselling. Many texts coming through on this. One from Matthew says, I refused to go to school in my teens. It was a hideous place, fueled by toxic masculinity, homophobia and violence. Being bullied, abused and in constant fear of caning by staff was nothing to be embraced. Watching others suffering physical punishment was deeply traumatic. The solution? My mother, who understood my situation absolutely, simply allowed me to stay at home and took charge of my learning. She worked full time and trusted me, rightly, to complete my side of the bargain, says Matthew, which included some weekend work with her. It saved me. And another says, my child is just so bored with the primary school curriculum. The unending focus on literacy and numeracy makes him feel like he's done the same thing every day for 7 years in year five and already so over it. And that speaks to Jim's point that each child is an individual and perhaps some school systems are not set up for that. On that, let's look at how this plays out in one particular school. Peter Hutton is the principal of Gisborne Montessori School, and he's the founder and director of Future Schools, which is a community of education leaders dedicated to transforming schooling. Peter Hutton, welcome to you.
Good morning, everyone, to what's a fascinating discussion already.
And one of such huge import to the families going through it. I know a few people experiencing this at the moment, and it is life-changing for the entire family. Peter, how have you handled this issue of school detachment and school refusal at your school as a principal?
Look, Hilary, I think it's an incredibly important issue. And, you know, I can only echo what Jim's mentioned this morning and Christine about needing to personalise programs for young people. I recently toured Finland and looked at their education system with Professor Pasi Solberg. And the thing that I really noted there is the enormous level of autonomy that schools had to directly assist the students that are in front of them rather than a top-down imposed model, and I think there's a lot to be learnt from that.
So school autonomy about individual students, but I understand that individual student agency is also important. How do you handle that at your school?
Look, I think agency is the key, and schools are on the whole far too big. I've only been in this particular role for 7 weeks, but already we're introducing personalised learning plans that are written by the young person themselves with the support of their parents and then supported by the school. And, you know, we literally tailor-make education for each young person. So how is it possible to be disenfranchised or upset when you're literally controlling all the elements that go into your education? I know that seems very pie in the sky, but it is able to be achieved at scale. I was formerly the principal of Templestowe College, where we had 1,150 students all on individualised learning plans, and that's within a government school, and we had 98% parent satisfaction.
I was wondering how that works within a system that also has attendance requirements and also involves standardised testing. Can you do that individualised learning and individualised tailoring and giving students a say in their education as well as fitting in within those broader structures?
Absolutely. We were fully compliant as a government school, as we obviously have to be. At this particular school, like part of my reason to moving into the independent system was that we have slightly greater freedom to meet the individual needs of young people. But this will be one of very few schools where a student can go literally from birth to university not having done a high stakes test. And that is possible within the current legal framework.
So, Peter, how do you engage parents with that process? I imagine there's a level of, you know, within parents who've already chosen to send their kids to a Montessori school of openness to this idea. But some parents might be thinking, well, I don't know, if we let the chickens run the hen house, how's that going to work?
The chickens do a pretty good job of running the hen house, frankly, Hilary. I think one of my central tenets in education is young people have actually got far more capacity than we give them credit for. And my experience, not only at this school, but, you know, there's 110 schools that we're working with as part of Future Schools across the country. Wherever we empower young people, we're inevitably blown away by their capacity. And frankly, there's not an issue with engaging parents because they're running from the traditional systems where their child is a number, not a human being. So it's not really hard to engage parents because the alternative is the failure that their young person's already experiencing.
What about teachers? I mean, we did this massive story on teacher burnout recently, and it's hard to see how teachers find the time or energy to tailor things to their students. Are your teachers somehow just massively better resourced? What's going on?
No, I think it's a complete flip on the mental model. Like we're you know, when you take away a lot of the administrative requirements from teachers and actually put some of the autonomy back in the hands of young people, they step up to the challenge. They become a pleasure to teach, not an animal to be driven with a stick, metaphorically. you know, when young people are keen on what they're learning, when they've got a bit of a say over what they're learning, when they're learning, with whom they're learning, it actually becomes a hugely pleasurable experience. But we're currently losing half of all teachers within the first 5 years because they go into education to make a positive difference to young people's lives, and they find that they're pseudo youth detention and justice workers because the system itself needs significant reform.
Christine, what are the best ways to re-engage kids? You're hearing about Peter Hutton's approach here at the Gisborne Montessori School. Do those approaches help with the factors that you see driving disengagement from school?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to hear from Jim, who has from both guests that have both extensive experiences in schools too. And I just want to reflect quickly on a project that we're working with on the department at the moment, and they are bringing well-being and mental health equal to learning for the first time ever. And that means that we're actually able to look at students, how they're coping in school, how are they going when they walk in the door, are they smiling, are they not even getting to that front door, and now teachers have agency to be able to respond to that, because the projects that we are working on, you know, directly with the department, are bringing forward, you know, well-being and mental health equal to the academic outcomes. So previously we didn't have this approach to holistic education, but we are seeing really strong moves, literally for term four moving forward, to address some of these really big challenges. So I think as soon as we have systemic changes across the profession that equal well-being and mental health to academic outcomes, we will start to see a change in prioritizing teacher strategies in the classroom, supporting plans for students who can be on individualized supports if they need them, going into government education. So I do see a positive shift even in the heartbreak that we're seeing coming back from COVID into schools. A number of families I work with, it's really challenging, really challenging. And sometimes the best option is to change schools for a term. But talking to your school, creating a plan, starting there is a priority first before you do make a really dramatic change to change suburbs or move and upheaval your family into a new community. So I do want to flag that there are positive changes coming. While we might not see them trickle down directly to teachers now, you know, this week, but hopefully we will start to see a much bigger focus on student wellbeing and belonging and identity in the classroom than we've ever seen before. And that is an exciting shift that COVID has brought us in this really challenging time. So I hold on to that kind of, you know, light at the end of the tunnel to see that actually for the first time we might be actually prioritizing students more than just what grade they might get, more than just their literacy and mathematical skill set that they have, but as a student for their whole well-being and a person.
And that's happening in Victoria. Professor Jim Waddeston, I'll read you this comment from Alison on our Facebook page. As a teacher, we're seeing so many children presenting with ADHD and anxiety undiagnosed because parents can't get them into a paediatrician. Too many are closing their books due to the high demand, putting a strain on schools to find ways of accommodating these children. When you look broadly across Australia, Jim, do we need more resources? How many more resources do we need in schools to help students with these issues that drive detachment?
Absolutely, Hilary. We definitely need more resources, but we need to focus them in the areas that Christine was talking about. And in Victoria, the government has now set up the Mental Health in Primary Schools project, where a person is being trained to be the wellbeing coordinator across the school. Now, not just to be able to think of programs and to be able to work with individuals, but to know how to refer those students on to professionals and to be able to make the contacts that schools probably have struggled with in the past. And so I think this is a great innovation. It's going to take a few more years to roll out. And the problem is now, I guess the other point I'd want to make before we finish is that I don't think anything we've talked about today is a problem of teachers or principals in schools at the moment. We've got this really dense Australian curriculum that takes up all of the time in a week and probably should have more time to implement it fully. And teachers are overwhelmed. And I think Peter talked about the fact that there's quite a strong movement now to get out of the profession. And so it's not just for students that we need to think about this ability to personalise and to create safety and visibility for young people who are struggling in schools. It's to give teachers the opportunity to be able to use some of their time to do that work. And I think at the moment, post-pandemic, if we're in that phase, people are really sort of worn out. Teachers in particular, there's a lot of well-being issues for them as well. They've been through a really difficult time and done an amazing job. So it's time, really, I think, to recalibrate and think about what is the focus of our teaching going forward. And it's not just to prepare young people for a job like we've thought about for the last 100 years. It's really to make sure that they've got the lifelong skills and capacity to be able to access all opportunities that come their way. A job is only one of those things. We need to focus on their own well-being and a proactive approach for young people to be able to manage their own well-being.
Well, it sounds like we're all on the same page that the school system needs revision. But for Jim, for individual kids for whom that system right now is not working, what are some alternatives? Like, we hear about flexible schools, virtual schools, homeschooling. How useful are they?
Well, they're very useful, but it's an eclectic bunch. And so, as you said, there's a whole range of different titles, but alternative schools is one title that's used, and flexi schools. And some of those schools are picking up those kids who are completely disengaged and giving them a second chance, and also those kids who are completely detached, find their way back into those places. And when you go into them, and I've spent a lot of time in my career visiting those centres in many states, they start with the individual, and so they talk to them about what's the problem, why did they disengage, what would you like to do, how can we make this work for you. And I know that happens in a traditional school, but they're in smaller groups, and there's a really great opportunity. But the warning I'd give about this is that some of these alternative or flexi schools aren't overly well regulated. And so in terms of how those processes work and whether they're based on an evidence base or research is still a concern to me. And, the overwhelming focus of those schools is to, put the child first. But we need to make sure that we're not replacing one problem with another. So to really get a handle on the processes and the practices used in those schools to be then inculcated into mainstream schools so that we can do more is something that's really important in terms of our going forward, to make sure that all young people can get the education that they need.
Yeah, and deserve. Professor Jim Watterson, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jim's Dean of the Melbourne Graduate School of Education at the University of Melbourne. Christine Grove, very much appreciate your time today. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you.
Christine's an educational and developmental psychologist and adjunct senior lecturer at Monash University. And Peter Hutton, thank you so much for giving us an insight into how your school works today too.
It's a pleasure, Hilary.
Peter Hutton's the principal of Gisborne Montessori School, founder and director too of Future Schools, which is a community of education leaders dedicated to transforming schooling.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.